vowed to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words.
For those who don't know him, tonight's speaker is Shoho Michael Newhall. Thank you very much for coming. I'm the resident teacher at Jikoji, our sister Zen Center up in Santa Cruz Mountains. And we practiced with our founder, Kogun, many years ago. And always a treat to have you come down and be with us. Thank you.
It's happened again. When I come down here, I get a little emotional. I think it was 1975 or 6. I came to Santa Cruz Zen Center with Koen Shinoroshi. The place was a little different than it is now. It was pretty funky, but it had its own sweet life. Few of us will remember, maybe. Thank you so much for holding up these walls with your strong backs, with your practice. Maintaining this place feels good. To say something, don't I? Okay. Last weekend, you came to Jikoji and gave a great talk, and I asked you what you were studying here, and you said, these days you were studying the middle way. So that's an ongoing topic, I take it, these days?
We just started.
Just started? Oh good. Me too. When I was a young student and I first heard about the middle way, I thought, not wrongly, but maybe in a limited way, I thought that the middle way spoke of our kind of balance or equanimity. And I'd heard the story of the Buddha who started his life in a very indulgent way and then went into a very ascetic practice and finally stopped and decided to, he came back to his body and mind and decided to take food and become healthy and found a middle ground, a workable middle ground where he could maintain his practice but still be accountable, you could say, to his body and to his mind. So my initial understanding of the middle way was the way of moderation, the way of not too tight and not too loose, the way of maintaining a view and also releasing a view at the same time. The way of, you could say, the way of generosity that took into account the whole person. Later on, I heard a understanding of the middle way that intrigued me even more. It was the middle way was rather than this kind of what you might call kind of compromise or this soft center or this place of stasis in the middle of two extremes. It was actually included the extremes. I think it's stated as the non-contradiction of opposites. Have you heard that before? So I liked that understanding. We all know that from our experience that the stimulus, the juice of life is gross. It's dramatic on the outside edges, and as you move in toward the center, things get a little more subtle. They almost disappear. In fact, strictly speaking, you could say in the absolute middle, nothing happens. I think another aspect of the middle way that we might include is that it's the middle way is comprehensive in this same respect, that it includes not just the best self, but the total self. I once heard a response that the sculptor, the American sculptor David Smith, made when he was asked about how he brought his self into his work. And the interviewer said that, asked him if he was bringing his best self into the work. And he said, absolutely not. I am not bringing my best self into my work. I am bringing my total self into the work. And my complete self into the work. When you think about that, that's pretty generous, you know, and pretty trusting to make your whole self available in, say, a work of art or any other expression. I imagine that you're studying much of the Madhyamaka teachings.
Eventually.
Nagarjuna and Chandrakirti and so on. The Prajnaparamita literature. So you've got a lot of work to do. Right? Yeah. Middle way is a big field. Yes. Well, this evening I'd like to maybe approach it a little bit tangentially in the sense of just as experience, as personal experience. Another word that's important to Buddhism, another concept that's important to Buddhism is, in Sanskrit it's called apeksha, it's equanimity. It's one of the four Brahma-viharas, the apramanas, the immeasurable expressions or gifts that we manifest as practitioners. There's compassion and sympathetic joy and loving kindness, and finally there's apeksha or equanimity. And it's also listed in the seven aspects of enlightenment, and it's the classical jhanas or stages is not quite right. Jhana means, actually strictly speaking, means knowledges or ways of becoming. The four jhanas, the fourth one of the form jhanas, the conditional jhanas, that the fourth one is equanimity, and that state of equanimity was the place where the Buddha, the Buddha woke up. The Buddha finished his work. So I thought tonight we could investigate this magical term called equanimity, which we've all heard that word, and it's kind of a golden word. It's kind of a glitter word in Buddhism, and it's not exclusive to Buddhism, too. I mean, we use it outside of this realm. So, I'd like to read a little something. This is from a book by Professor Nagano. He's a Buddhist scholar, a Japanese Buddhist scholar who was at Kawazawa University when Kobun Shino Roshi was a student there. So he, Kobun, in Kyoto, Kawazawa. He also studied with, Koban also studied with Koro Sawaki as well when he was there. Nagano taught their essay is about it's called Tranquil Flow of Mind, an interpretation of Upeksha. And he goes back to a Yogacharian teacher named Shiramati, about 6th century Yogacharian teacher. And he talks about what equanimity is. And this might sound a little technical, there's some Sanskrit terms in here, but actually it's not, it's very experiential. So, there's three aspects about this, and we'll talk about these in a little bit. Upeksha is equilibrium or samatha of the mind. Samatha, by the way, is the same root as samadhi. It means to be one with, to be unified with, to be identical to. Upeksha is equilibrium or samatha of the mind. That's one. Tranquil flow or prasatata of the mind, and effortlessness, anabogata of the mind. So these three aspects: equilibrium, tranquil flow of the mind, and effortlessness. By three words, the stages of upeksha at the beginning, middle, and end are respectively illustrated. Here, inequality of the mind is either mental depression or mental exaltation. Upon extinction of this inequality, one first attains equilibrium of the mind. Then, as for prasatata, without volitional effort and without special exertion, the concentrated and even mind takes place in due order. And this is the tranquil flow of mind. However, in this stage, the mind is still followed by anxiety of mental depression and exaltation, because it has not been cultivated for a long period of time. After that, as for anabogata, since this meditational exercise reaches higher and higher degrees, and its adversaries, such as the diversities of the mind, become farther and farther away, this anxiety is nullified. Then the stages of effortlessness of the mind is reached by one for whom there is no need to make any effort to obtain remedies for mental depression or mental exaltation. I hope that wasn't too obtuse, but this is the understanding of equanimity as, first of all, the establishment of a kind of balance or you might call it generosity, a kind of establishment of open generosity for all the activities all the impressions, all the thoughts, all the feelings, all the sensations as a kind of working space to come into recognition as equal and non-differentiated. Did everyone get that? One of the classic examples of this is it's very common to San Francisco Zen Center tradition is the metaphor of the wind bell. So a wind bell. What does a wind bell do? A wind bell responds to the wind, right? Not too difficult. The wind bell just responds to the wind. And whether the wind is coming from the north or the south or the east or the west, the wind bell responds to the conditions of that wind. And when the wind isn't blowing, there's no sound from the wind bell. So whether the wind is blowing or not blowing, the wind bell is, you could say, fine, happy, and able to continue to be a wind bell, whether it's making a lot of noise, a lot of racket, or nothing at all. Rujing, the teacher of Dogen, had a poem about this. He said, "A mouth hanging in emptiness. The wind bell does not care. If the wind comes from the south, the north, the east, or the west, whatever comes, there is just pure response. Pure response is pure wisdom." And then the poem goes on. Ding, ding, ding. So we know in our practice life and our understanding of the Dharma that to grasp at things, to attach to things, to attach to a view, to attach to an object, to attach to a sensation is a problem, right? And we also know that to push that sensation or thought or idea away, to contract from it, is also a problem. So the question for us is, as practitioners of the middle way, how to be completely involved with our life and our environment and our mental condition and our problems and our fears, and also be completely free of them. How do we do that? Samatha, the equipoise or equanimity, the seeing that all things are the same, that underlying their differentiation or along with their differentiation, all things are intimately involved with one another and fundamentally the same. That's samatha. That's understanding the undifferentiated nature of existence. Shall we do that? All together now? Who wants to start? Oh, you want to start?
Yeah.
Oh, good, good. Me too. I want to start. Sometimes I'm an artist. I paint pictures occasionally, and I use pigments, and I have, even at this advanced age, I have color preferences or color arrangement preferences. In other words, like I'm biased about liking, say, for instance, blue and a certain kind of blue. And I've been using this blue in conjunction with a kind of ochre color for the last few paintings. It's kind of a purplish blue, and it's an ochre color that I like this combination. I've been using it a lot. I confess and acknowledge this affection for this blue. I'm sorry. But my practice is my intentional practice in this activity of not just painting but this work as well, understanding the middle way and practicing equanimity, is right alongside that appreciation and devotion to that blue, to understand all the colors that are not that blue, and to, in a kind of generous way, include all those colors that are not that blue. In other words, I remember, and I, in a way, I confirm the blue, and I remember, I recollect that all those other colors are, in a sense, conspiring to make that blue. Because without all those other colors, that blue would not be, it wouldn't be anything. It wouldn't be a color. And in trying to practice equanimity, in trying to bring to that preference a broader vision and an extended vision, I try to remember and recollect all that is not blue as actually making that blue. Does that make sense? Yeah, yeah. So it takes some work because we're actually, in a certain sense, we're habituated and geared and maybe even genetically programmed, for all I know, to identify and reify our existence according to, what would you do, certain conditions that have to do with our survival or our identity or our the way we negotiate the world. And without discounting that, as a practitioner of equanimity, as a practitioner of the middle way, to expand that view, that it includes all those other colors, is samatha. It's practicing the non-differentiation of dharmas. The non-differentiation of all phenomena. It's kind of like, I like this metaphor too, of being kind of like being a maitre d' in a restaurant. As a practitioner of the middle way, what do? We hold the middle, or we posit our place in the middle. It's like a maitre d' being in the front entryway, yeah. Usually they have a little stand, right? And the menus get passed out and stuff. And there's the maitre d', there's the host who receives the guests. So obviously we have our favorite guests. We have the guests that we like. The guests that tip well, who don't make a mess, who behave themselves, and maybe the guests that are our friends that we love. And then we also have other guests that come who are, well, you know, they're slobs, or they're troublemakers, or they're a big, you know, they're a problem for us because they could, you know, they're expressing themselves in ways that don't confirm our idea of what a guest is, or the standards of our restaurant. So, but as a good host, as a worthy host, we have to receive them and sit them down and give them a good meal and hope they pay their bill and so on. The point is that we are that front door. We are that place, that middle place, and that's our station. So sammatha is to recognize all our guests and to be a good host. And yes, we prefer that color blue, but in the midst of receiving that color blue, we still keep the door open, or we're still receptive, or we still accommodate mentally, physically, emotionally, the whole structure or the whole context of all phenomena. That is, that they're thoroughly independent, that they rely on each other, that they're conditioned. This is hard work, now that I mentioned it. Do you want to say something?
There might be another metaphor from painting that occurred to me, that what we call negative space performs in a similar way, allowing us to perceive what I suppose we have to call positive space or shapes, but the words negative and positive not being so helpful, but would that be another metaphor?
That sounds good. I remember that. I remember in figure drawing, to really understand the shapes and the forms of the figure, that one of the assignments in figure drawing was to actually focus on the negative space. We tend, when we draw, we get obstructed by something called image identification, that we identify an arm as an arm, or we identify a leg as a leg, and then we have in trying to draw it, we're actually obstructed by that pure seeing, because we have that image identification. And when we can drop that, we can drop that image identification, which is what looking at a negative space can do, then we're actually free to see it as it is, rather than with our idea or model of what an arm is or something. Yeah, that's what you meant, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Supports it, mm-hmm. Confirms it in a way. That's great. Yeah, actually, better than blue. So, Thiramati, the Yogacharyan teacher Thiramati, said that Upon extinction of this inequality, one first attains equilibrium of the mind. Then, without volitional effort and without special exertion, in other words, he's saying, this happens naturally. This just unfolds. The concentrated and even mind takes place in due order. In other words, you establish a kind of composure and peace and connection with what you're experiencing. And this is the tranquil flow of mind. I thought it interesting that it's stated as a flow of mind, not as a state of mind, but that the mind still continues to function, to maintain the world, to maintain your negotiation or your relationship to things and places. But it flows at this point. It's fluid. It isn't point, object, choice, blue, not blue. It's more fluid than that. So this teacher says, It happens that way. But then that's called prasatta, which means tranquil flow of mind. But then he says, even though that takes place, still there is this concern about what he calls laya or mental laxity. In other words, and the opposite of that is mental, he calls it exaltation or excitement, or he might call it like we have a... we've noticed in our practice that when practice is going well, there's a kind of balance between shamatha and vipassana. Shamatha is settling, tranquilizing, calming, pacifying. Vipassana is mindfulness. It's discursive thinking. It's being alert. But if one of those, if shamatha or vipassana in meditation, and this is kind of our working, this is how we work with this process, by sitting down together in this very deliberate way, meditating. So we look at our minds. In practicing a balance between shamatha and vipassana, we find this equanimity, we find this kind of good middle ground. If we're too much involved in shamatha, if we can sink into laxity, into laya, we'll kind of get in a dreamy state or a sleepy state, or get spaced out in meditation. And if we bring too much excitement or mental stimulus or even tension to our practice, or we're thinking too much, we're moving too far into vipassana. So the meditation finds this, good meditation finds this middle ground, not too tight, not too loose, calming and settling and pacifying with shamatha, with our attention to an object of meditation, with the breath or the posture, but also being alert, being perky, being present. So Suramati says, that the meditation exercise that we do reaches higher and higher degrees. And its adversaries, which he calls the diversities of the mind, become farther and farther away. This anxiety of lapsing into laya, or what he calls mental depression or mental exaltation, decreases, and we actually settle into equanimity. Is it time already? Huh? Oh goodness! Do people want to say something, or is there time for?
I'm not in a rush. If you want to finish.
Huh. Okay. This is a big topic, so... Balancing the cool tones and warm tones, yeah. Well, this just maybe as a final statement that this practice of equanimity is a big job. We have a lot of momentum in our discursive life, in our mental life, to fix, to have fixed views and to have a bias. And so let's practice being, even knowing that that's so, let's practice bringing to our views, bringing to our sensations, bringing to our experience a more generous and expanded view that includes the whole works. And make that part of our practice. Okay. Okay. Big job. Thank you.
Unless I vow to save them, delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma, the gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow.